Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 5 of Unboxing God with me, McCall. Traditionally, religions hold up their founders or other great prophets as an example of the perfect way to live. From Buddha to Jesus to Muhammad, these leaders embody characteristics and qualities that their followers strive to uphold. In short, the religious believer is attempting to emulate the positive traits of their God or prophet by mimicking their words and deeds. But what if we decouple that striving for self-betterment from the religious anchoring to which it is typically moored? Is it possible to exemplify the best in humanity without any faith in a higher power? Basically, can we be good without God? Today, I want to take a look at an ancient Greek philosophy called Stoicism. I've asked Ryan, the husband of a dear friend of mine, to come on the show today and talk to us about his journey to and through the practice of Stoicism. Stoicism is a school of philosophy that's centered around personal ethics. It was founded about 300 years before the time of Jesus, just to put it in a little perspective. Let's turn this over to Cassidy and her husband, Ryan.
Hi, this is Cassidy Villano.
And this is Ryan Villano.
We're from Dallas and we practice Stoicism.
Yes, we do.
So, Ryan, the story goes that when you were like 9 years old, you picked up this coin off the playground, right?
Yes.
And it had the Serenity Prayer on it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you actually know what the Serenity Prayer was at that age?
Not a single bit. I just picked it up because it was super shiny. And like most birds do, you just pick them up and collect things like that.
And you carried that coin around for years, right?
Years and years, right past high school.
Yeah. And so you didn't actually figure out what the Serenity Prayer was until you went to program meetings with me, 12-step program meetings.
Yeah, I just went with you and you guys started reciting this prayer that I've known for so long.
Okay, so the Serenity Prayer is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
mm-hmm.
the courage to change the things I can,
yes,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes.
So this is basically just a Stoic phrase packaged up in a prayer form to a higher power, right?
Yeah, you just put God in front of it and it's, that's what it is. When you remove the God aspect of it, it's Stoicism at its core.
Okay, so what is it about the Serenity Prayer that appeals to you?
Well, it's really that third part back in the day. It allowed me to look at the world differently, right? Because it's the wisdom to know the difference. So it changes the way you perceive the world about the good things and the bad things in the world, to see obstacles as opportunities and not just negative things in the world.
Choose not to be harmed, and you won't feel harmed. Don't feel harmed, and you haven't been. Marcus Aurelius. The Stoics had an exercise called turning the obstacle upside down. I think what they meant to do was almost make it impossible not to practice the art of philosophy. Because if you can properly turn a problem upside down, every bad becomes an opportunity for good. Suppose for a second that you're trying to help someone, and they respond by becoming surly or unwilling to cooperate. Instead of making your life more difficult, the Stoic exercise says they're actually directing you to a new virtue, for example, patience or understanding. Even the death of someone close to you can be a chance to show fortitude. Marcus Aurelius was the Roman emperor from 161 to 180 Christian era. He was also a Stoic philosopher, and he described it like this: the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. This idea might sound familiar because it's also the same thinking behind Obama's teachable moments. In the run-up to the 2008 election, Joe Klein asked Obama how he'd made the decision to respond to the Reverend Wright scandal. Obama said something like, "When the story broke, I realized the best thing to do wasn't damage control. It was to speak to Americans like adults." And what he ended up doing was turning a negative situation into the perfect platform for his landmark A More Perfect Union speech about race, in which he sought to place Wright's comments in a historical and sociological context. In that speech, Obama denounced Wright's remarks, but he did not disown him as a person. The common refrain about successful entrepreneurs is that they take advantage of, even create, opportunities. Well, to the Stoic, everything is opportunity. The Reverend Wright scandal, a frustrating situation where your help goes unappreciated by a friend, the death of a loved one. None of these are opportunities in the normal sense of the word. In fact, they're quite the opposite. They're obstacles. But what a Stoic does is turn every obstacle into an opportunity, creating stepping stones from stumbling blocks. There's no good or bad to the practicing Stoic. There's only perception. And you control your perception.
Okay, Ryan, so training your perception to avoid good and bad. How do you do that? That sounds hard.
Well, it does sound hard if you put it that way, because you're not trying to avoid the good and the bad. What you're trying to do is accept the good and the bad, and to see things and to see them for what they are and to accept them for what they are. So you don't have to train yourself to do this. You just have to see them for what they are.
Okay, but even still, you know, if I'm having a bad day, you know, the dog runs away, like just happened last week, or I lock my keys in the car, like how do you not have a reaction to that?
Well, you sit back and you think about how you could do it better the next time it happens. I mean, on the spot, it's going to take a while, but over time, when you start seeing this occurrence as something that's giving you a reaction inside, you don't have to necessarily react on it on the outside once you start thinking about it at the moment. So you become proactive the next time something like that happens instead of being reactive.
Okay, proactive. But what about the big events? You know, what if somebody you know passes away? How do you train your perception for something like that?
If someone passes away, obviously it's going to affect you emotionally. And when it does, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the emotions that you feel. But the thing is, you don't have to react to those emotions. You can sense them and feel them and have them happen to you, but you don't have to actually react to them. You just accept them as things that you need to feel because of the thing that happened. And then you just move on.
Wait, so are you telling me to not feel my feelings, though?
No, not at all. I want you to feel your feelings. I want you to assess and see where your feelings are, and you just feel them as they hit you and accept them when they do hit you. But what I'm saying is to not act based on those emotions, to control your actions and not blindly follow the emotions that ensue due to an event. I mean, this might sound hard for most people, but this is an example for a big event. But if you do this enough with the smaller things in life and the big things happen, then you'll know how to deal with it much better because you've done the smaller things. So you say you lost your keys and you get angry. You accept the fact that you're angry because now you're going to be late somewhere and whatever. But now you don't have to punch a wall out. You can accept the fact that you're angry and you lost your keys and then keep looking for it with a clear mind because now you've accepted that anger. And then over time, these little things, you can train yourself to see better, your perception better.
How beautifully Plato put it. Whenever you want to talk about people, it's best to take a bird's eye view and see everything all at once. Of gatherings, armies, farms, weddings and divorces, births and deaths, noisy courtrooms or silent spaces, every foreign people, holidays, memorials, markets, all blended together and arranged in a pairing of opposites. Marcus Aurelius. Marcus would often practice this exercise that's referred to as taking the view from above, or Plato's view. It invites us to take a step back, zoom out, and see life from a higher vantage point than our own. This exercise, envisioning all the millions and millions of people, all the armies, farms, weddings and divorces, births and deaths, prompts us to change perspective and reminds us how very small we are. It reorients us, and as Stoic scholar Pierre Hadot put it, the view from above changes our value judgment on things. Luxury, power, war, and the worries of everyday life become ridiculous. But seeing how small we are in the grand scheme of things is only one portion of this exercise. The second, more subtle point, is to tap into what Stoics call sympatheia, or mutual interdependence with the whole of humanity. Later on in this episode, Ryan's wife, my friend Cassidy, and I will unbox this idea a little more. I think it's worth more than just a brief mention here. As astronaut Edgar Mitchell, one of the first people to actually experience a real view from above, put it, in outer space, you develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world, and a compulsion to do something about it. Take a step back from your own concerns and remind yourself of your duty to others. Try Plato's view.
Okay, so we're talking about taking a view from above, right? Seeing the big picture. And I feel like I really relate to this. I'm a big picture person, like Google Maps in the car. What am I doing? I got to pan out on that map because I need to see the whole route, 3 steps ahead, what turn I'm going to take down the street, and the general direction I'm going in. Like, yeah. I need the whole picture. I'm not a details person in that regard. But when we're talking about big picture, taking a view from above, what does that mean in terms of real life?
Real life, like as in losing your keys, real life?
Yeah, losing your keys, you know, Jack escaping from the backyard last week, you know, someone passing away that's really close to you. Like, what does this have to do with the big picture?
And the big picture in that sense is, again, taking a going up above like a bird's eye view and seeing that these incidents aren't localized to you. They happen to everybody.
Mm.
They happen in different ways. There's different variables that change, but they're all very similar. And most everybody's going to act the same way or react to it. And some people aren't. But looking out from above, you can see that you're not the only one experiencing these sets of emotions due to these certain sets of events. It was Carl Sagan who wrote about the pale blue dot.
Mm.
As you go out from space and look at the Earth from far away, it's nothing but a pale blue dot. And that everybody and all the worries and all the wars and everything in the whole world could be summarized into this one little piece of speck in space. And that it all really doesn't matter and matters at the same time. And that's what it means to look at it from above. Is to make that realization that the small things that really bother you don't matter, but what you do about them still does matter.
So you're saying everything matters and nothing matters.
Yes.
How does that relate to me in real life?
It relates to you in a way that it's not just you that's ever having felt that feeling. In that sense, it doesn't really matter because there are people who have felt that exact same thing and have dealt with it in better ways than you have, and you could learn from those people.
So human experiences are universal.
Yes. Everyone feels the same thing. It's how you deal with them that ends up changing the way you're living your life.
You know, that's a really interesting sentiment because, you know, everything matters, nothing matters is something. It's this huge idea that can make you feel so isolated and alone. I know it does that for me, but when you break it down like that, you know, that everyone has probably felt this way at some point, and you can relate to that. If you dig deep enough and go far enough, you can probably find somebody who's been through it, at least in a similar way. That makes me feel less alone. That makes me feel like there's community out there, maybe that I just haven't tapped into.
Exactly. And that's one of the good things that's come about this pandemic is, although you feel isolated being inside and quarantining yourself, there's this realization that you're not the only one doing it. Everybody mm-hmm. else is doing it too. Mm-hmm. And that togetherness of everyone doing the same thing you are puts you together.
Together and, in unity. Yep. Yeah. Even though we're apart.
Exactly.
The chief task in life is simply this: to identify and separate matters so that I can say clearly to myself which are externals not under my control and which have to do with the choices I actually control. Where then do I look for good and evil? Not to the uncontrollable externals, but within myself, to the choices that are my own. Epictetus. The single most important practice in Stoic philosophy, as I understand it, is differentiating between what we can change and what we can't, what we can control and what we must let go of, what we have influence over and what we do not. If a flight is delayed because of weather, I promise you, no amount of yelling at an airline representative is going to end that storm and get you home any faster. No amount of wishing is going to make you taller or shorter or born in a different country. No matter how hard you try, you really can't make someone like you. And on top of that, time spent hurling yourself at these immovable objects is time not spent on the things we can change. Try returning to this question daily. In each and every trying situation, journal and reflect on it constantly. Because if you can focus on making clear what parts of your day are within your control and which parts are not, you will not only be happier, but you will have a distinct advantage over other people who fail to realize that they're fighting an unwinnable battle.
So we're talking about if this is within my control. Is it within my control or is it not within my control? So what does that mean? I can only control my actions, my attitudes, and my behaviors. That's it. I can't mm-hmm. control you, even though I'd like to think I can sometimes, because you're my husband and you should do things a certain way.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. You're your own person. You have your own actions and behaviors and attitudes to worry about, not mine. So I used to be the world's worst control freak. You know, I thought everybody should do things a certain way. My friends, my family, my job, my managers, that if they would just do it this way, the way that I saw fit, everything would be okay. That caused me a lot of grief for a long time. And I'm 31. It took me a long time to figure this out. So being in a 12-step program the past 6 months consistently this time, the Serenity Prayer just revolutionized the way that I think about things. Once I finally got it, I got it. And I know that you've been saying to me for years, you know, as long as we've known each other, you know, talking me through issues at work or issues with friends, you know, asking me if I can control what they do, working with me about whether or not I can control that situation. I didn't hear it. It took me a long time to finally get it. So,
yeah, I mean, I do remember all that with your coworkers and your bosses and all that at work. And we would make lists of what you can do, and it just frustrated you at the end because all of it was things that only you can do, and it didn't really affect everyone else. You couldn't change your boss, you couldn't change your coworkers, or any of the work that was placed on your lap. But Stoicism actually delves deeper than that as far as choice goes, because in Stoicism, it's the choice about your perception, because it's not just about your external world. Your body isn't even yours to control. You can get kidnapped tomorrow and you can't control that, but you can control how you perceive that. People in internment camps were put in internment camps out of their own. It wasn't their choice, but some survived because they saw things differently than the others who decided to give up at that point.
It's interesting that you say that. I know that we both read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
And I know that that was life-changing for me. You know, the fact that Viktor Frankl survived a concentration camp during World War II. But his mindset while he was in the concentration camp was different than a lot of people's there, because he realized that the one thing that he could control was himself, the way that he viewed other people.
Yeah, he viewed things as a study. He had a goal for when he got out to spread knowledge of it's all about your mind and the way you think. And if you decide to give up in your mind, your body will give up. So this goes back into Stoicism, because it really is about how you think about things and what you can and can't control. He had goals in his mind about giving people hope of the future, even though while they're being tortured and put to work, people are cold and really hungry. If you had to focus on something else, you could, and it helped you get through the day. It's a very good book.
I mean, granted, that's a really extreme example of
it is
surviving something as horrendous as a concentration camp, but a lot of the same mindset is there.
It is.
If you change your mindset, things will change for you. And I think that's what we talk about all the time. You know, one of my favorite things that I've learned just in program is A plus B equals C. If you change A and you don't change B, C is still going to change.
Yes.
The outcome is still going to change, even if you just change yourself.
Yes.
The great German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche would describe his formula for human greatness as amor fati, a love of fate. He once wrote that one wants nothing to be different, not forward, not backwards, not in all eternity. Not merely bear what is necessary, still less conceal it, but love it. Another Stoic, Epictetus, who as a crippled slave had faced adversity after adversity, echoed the same sentiment. Do not seek for things to happen the way you want them to. Rather, wish that what happens happen the way it happens. Then you will be happy. It's why amor fati is the Stoic exercise and mindset that you take on for making the best out of everything that happens, treating each and every moment, no matter how challenging, as something to be embraced, not avoided. To not only be okay with it, but to accept it to the point of appreciation. To love it and be better for it. So that like oxygen to a fire, obstacles and adversity become fuel for your potential.
So tell me, how can you love everything that happens? I'm just going to say it. How do you do that?
Because it happens and it's happened. That's really all there is to it. You can't change the fact that it happens or it has happened. The only thing you can do is accept the fact that it has. And the only thing you can change is the way you think about it and what you do about it.
Wait, but accepting that it happened and loving it are two totally different things. I might accept that it happened, but how do you get to a point of loving that it happened?
Because it would have happened anyways. That is it. Whatever would have happened or could have happened would have happened. And when you accept that, you end up embracing it. And when you embrace it, that is when you can make changes in what could happen. I know it sounds kind of like it's circling, but to embrace fate means that things that aren't in your control needs to be accepted and loved. You have to be able to, if it rains tomorrow, enjoy the drops of rain instead of looking at the mud under your shoe when you walk in the house. That is the viewpoint that needs to be seen in order for you to be more in a calm state.
You know, I think I understand what you're saying. I felt for a long time that my whole life was just out of control. You know, things happened to me that I didn't want to ever happen. I never asked for them to happen. But there was a point in time that changed everything when I started viewing my actions as my actions, not as my reactions, not as my whatever else. When I started taking responsibility for my own actions, I started to love what I was doing. I started to love the choices that I was making because I made them, because I finally felt like I made them.
Yeah. And amor fati means to love the fate that's been handed to you, right? Mm-hmm. Bad things have happened to you, but they made you who you are right now, who understands what it is to be you, mm-hmm. which means you have to have loved the things that has happened to you, even though they're horrible. That's what it means to love it, to accept the things that's happened to you and use it to fuel you right now.
So, for example, I'm a sexual assault survivor. I couldn't understand why sexual assault had happened to me for a long time, had happened to me. But once I finally accepted that it had happened and I changed the way that I looked at it, I was finally able to accept that it had happened and move forward and choose what I got to do with that from there on out. Once I could choose that I didn't have to be a victim anymore, just a victim, I could reclaim that as survivor and move forward and then go into teaching or speaking or writing about sexual assault in order to help other people in that area.
Exactly. It's a different way of looking at things to better help people instead of, for the lack of a better word, wallowing in the things that you have experienced. Mm-hmm. For me, amor fati, which is the love of fate, is closely entwined with another big idea of Stoicism, which is memento mori, which is remember you will die. Because that really hits deep in the fact that death is a fate that is given to everybody that's born into this world. And that you have to love that to understand that the things that you cherish in this world will not follow you because you will die. And the things that hurt you in this world will not follow you because you will die. And that gives you a sense of calmness and gives you a broad picture of the world. And it kind of ties everything together. The love of fate and the fact that you will die as your fate at the end is revolutionary. It has changed the way I see the world and the way I interact with everybody in the world.
So it's like saying that once you accept the fact that you will die because it's going to happen, then you can actually start living and focusing your time and attention, what time and attention that you do have, on the things that matter to you.
Yes, that's exactly it.
There's a lot more to be said and unboxed about Stoicism, except I think I'm going to save it for next week's bonus episode when Cassidy and I come back and talk about wisdom, temperance, courage, and justice, the four core virtues of Stoicism, If you have any thoughts about those virtues or about Stoicism, I'd really love to hear your voice. You can call Waldo Love 3 and leave a message, or you can record a voice memo as either a WAVE or MP3 or anything else, and we'll figure it out, and just email it to me, waldolovesme@gmail.com. Who knows? Maybe your voice will be featured on next week's episode. Until then, this is McCall. Thanks for joining me. Bye.